Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Going through a divorce situation, and I have to tell you, that is the most difficult sort of conflict I've ever dealt with.
If you happen to step into somebody's landmine, then watch out.
You're either part of the tribe or you're not.
You are automatically perceived as having an agenda when you do not.
It's awfully, awfully difficult, and I don't know how you de-escalate that thing.
That thing is conflict. Not just minor day-to-day differences, but conflict in its extreme form, intractable, seemingly insoluble. It could be intimate, like a divorce, or massive and public, like political partisanship. The kind of conflict where nothing you say seems to get through to the other side.
You just don't know what to do. It's like, I've done everything I can do. I cannot. My passion just is not coming through to them because they just don't care.
So Amanda Ripley joins us now. And Amanda, do those voices sound familiar to you?
Yes, painfully familiar. Yes.
Well, Amanda Ripley is an investigative journalist and New York Times bestselling author, and she's written a new book called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. So what is happening to people when they reach that point of conflict? The point that you heard in these are actually messages we got from On Point listeners when we said we were going to do this show. We got quite a number of voicemails. So you touched a nerve here, Amanda. But what's happening to people when they reach this point in a conflict?
So conflict is good. That's how we get better as people, as groups. High conflict is different. In high conflict, our brains behave differently. We start to make mistakes. We can become consumed by the us versus them dynamic of the conflict. And everything we do to try to get out of the conflict usually makes it worse in high conflict. The conflict kind of takes on a life of its own. And maybe the most chilling pattern I've seen in every high conflict I've followed is that the people involved eventually start to mimic the behavior of their adversaries. It's very, very hard to resist doing that, usually without realizing it.
This is so important because everything that you just said, Amanda, I think to a certain degree defines American life right now. So hang on for a second because I also want to introduce Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, who's going to join us for this hour to help think through the causes and impacts of high conflict. Jack, it's good to have you.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Amanda.
So, Amanda, can we get a more specific definition of what you mean by high conflict? And tell us the story about why you wanted to look into high conflict.
Well, about 4 years ago, I started to feel like, as a journalist, I had to do something differently. It just felt like we were stuck in so many conflicts that weren't going anywhere interesting, right? On social media, in the news. And I knew that if I didn't do something differently, I was afraid I was just going to make the conflict worse. But I didn't know what that was. So I followed people who were themselves, at some point, trapped in high conflicts of all kinds. A politician in California, a former gang leader in Chicago, an environmental activist in England, all kinds of people who were in high conflict and are now in something that I now call good conflict. So they haven't given up. They haven't changed their mind. They're still fighting for the thing they care most about, but they're much more effective than they were in high conflict. And they're also much less, you know, miserable in their own heads, because high conflict does tend to make everyone kind of miserable to different degrees.
And can you tell us the story of how, if you don't mind, I mean, you write about it in the book, experiences in your own life, your young life in particular, sort of had shaped your views of what conflict is?
Yeah, I grew up with a fair amount of conflict in my own family. It wasn't, you know, terrible, But I had a mother who went through bouts of depression and anxiety. And she often, when she became frightened, she became angry. And that happened a lot because of her own history, right? And so there was a lot of fighting. And I used to sit at the top of the stairs. Some listeners may identify with this as a kid, sit at the top of the stairs and just listen to the fights. Whereas my brother, my older brother, much more wisely, I now realize, would go into the woods and play or take out his action figures in his room and just kind of hide away from it. But I, for whatever reason, to me, it felt safest to monitor the conflict, to sort of keep it in my sights, to see if I could predict it, you know. Obviously, that's a child's interpretation of conflict. But I feel like looking back on it, I sort of maintained that habit as a journalist covering crime, disasters, terrorism for Time magazine for many years and other places where, you know, I would just sort of be on the edges of a conflict. And in that way, it sort of gave me some sense of control, even though, of course, it was not real control. And that, I think that's why it bothered me so much after the 2016 election, when I felt like I couldn't make sense of what was happening in the country and that the conflict seemed really out of control. So this was my attempt belatedly to change how I understand conflict.
Hmm. Well, we'll talk a little bit later. It's so interesting to hear you say that as a journalist, you just kept sort of monitoring conflict. And later on, I want to ask you or hear from you about how your view in the past few years has been to, like, not just monitor it, but get underneath it, because there's a big difference there. But Jack Beattie, let me just turn to you here for a minute. It does seem very, very vital at this point in time in American life, both personally and nationally, to understand sort of the impact and how to resolve what Amanda describes as high conflict, does it not?
It does, and we need examples, don't we? We need sort of pictures of possibility. And one comes, strangely enough, at a moment of very high conflict indeed, the Camp David Accords of 1978. Jimmy Carter at Camp David with President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin. Amanda's epigram to the book is out. Beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there, from the Sufi poet Rumi. Well, here's a moment when Prime Minister Begin met Jimmy Carter on a field. It was the 13th day of the talks. Everything had broken down on the question of Jerusalem. The United States had this side letter that was meaningless. Begin couldn't accept it. It wasn't Jerusalem. The understory, in Amanda's terms, was Begin's whole life, fighting. In his autobiography, he refers to himself as a new species of human being, the fighting Jew, fought against the Poles, fought against the Nazis, fought against the British, fought against the Arabs. He couldn't do it. He couldn't say yes to peace. So Carter resigned to the end of this you know, epic meeting, went to see him, but he took to see him to say goodbye, and he took with him photographs of him of the three principals. Begin had asked Carter to autograph photographs for his grandchildren, and so he handed, as he was leaving, he handed these photographs to Begin. "Mr. Prime Minister, I brought you the photographs you asked for," Carter said. "Thank you, Mr. President." Carter handed Begin the photographs, and the Prime Minister coolly thanked him again. Then he noticed that Carter had signed the top photograph to Ayelet. Carter had sent to Israel to find out the names. Begin froze. He looked at the next one, to Osnat. His lips trembled, and tears suddenly sprang into his eyes. One by one, he said their names aloud, weeping openly. Orit, Mariev, Michael. There were eight of them. Carter also broke down. He said to Begin, this is from Lawrence Wright's wonderful account, "I wanted to be able to say, this is when your grandfather and I brought peace to the Middle East." The scale of the failure had never been more evident. Carter walked away. Minutes later, as he's telling Sadat This is all gone down. Begin can't break from this tar pit in Amanda's imagery. Begin calls and says, I will accept a new wording on this meaningless letter about Jerusalem. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Begin stepped out of his identity as the fighter and became the grandfather. Mm. And that changed history.
Mm. Amanda, what do you think about that?
Wow, I had never heard that story. And it reminds me of so many examples of people leaving high conflict, even temporarily. It often happens when other identities they already have get ignited, as happened there by Carter. So it is often identities as parents or children. In Colombia, I talk in the book about an advertisement that the government ran that turned out to be surprisingly effective in getting FARC guerrilla members, the sort of rebel fighters, to voluntarily lay down their arms and leave the jungle. And the message was run during major national soccer games, because the guerrilla members would all listen to those on the radio. And it just invited people to come home to watch the game with their mothers and fathers, with their children. And there are lots of questions about why this worked and so many other ads didn't. But based on everything I've heard, it is much easier to ignite someone's other existing identities outside the conflict than it is to ask them to give up their conflict identity. So it's a pattern you see again and again. And after those ads ran, according to new research by Juan Pablo Aparicio in Colombia, 20 FARC members would defect the next day, much more than the average. So it was something that had this incredible effect without violence.
That is absolutely fascinating. Okay, so when we come back, we're going to hear the story of another person that you profiled in the book. The new book is High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. It's by investigative journalist Amanda Ripley. Jack Beatty is also with us. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Amanda Ripley. She's an investigative journalist, best-selling author, and her new book is High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Jack Beatty is also with us. He's On Point news analyst. And Amanda, I just wanted to read back to you how one reviewer of your book sort of summarized what you present to us as high conflict, because I think it is so powerful. The reviewer says, quote, "Once people get drawn into high conflict, they become certain of their own righteousness, make negative assumptions about those who have a different position, and come to believe that the only acceptable solution is total victory." Now, I challenge anybody listening to this right now to assert with confidence that they are not susceptible to that kind of high conflict. I think it's fundamentally human, and therefore one of the reasons why we have to understand it as deeply as we can. I mean, Amanda, is anybody immune to being sucked into that kind of self-affirming righteous absolutism?
That's a good way to describe it. You know, I followed a conflict expert, Gary Friedman, who knows pretty much everything there is to know about conflict, who's, you know, written 3 books on the subject, helped 2,000 clients through really ugly conflicts of all kinds. He teaches at Harvard and Stanford. And a few years ago, he ran for office in his little town in California, hoping to fix politics and make it less toxic. And guess what happened? As he fell into high conflict, as he now fully admits, he's not proud of it, but it is very hard to resist the magnetism of high conflict. And so the key really is to try to figure out what high conflict is so you can identify it and just be very careful about avoiding the conditions that tend to lead to high conflict. Because once it starts, it is very hard to get out of.
But isn't it a fact, but it seems to me that people naturally think, well, that would never happen to me. It's happening to that other person. It's the other person on the other side of the conflict that's feeling that that sort of inescapable righteousness. If only they would see sense, then the conflict would end.
This is, yeah, the distortion of high conflict is it makes it so clear that you are so right and you just feel baffled by the other side. I mean, they just seem crazy. There's just no other way to understand it, right? And you will find yourself doing that even about people you don't know. You'll never know, you know? And so we're humans. We make a lot of mistakes normally, but usually our mistakes help us, so to speak, you know? And in high conflict, they really don't. They really do eventually start to harm the things we care most about, the thing that brought us into the conflict. You know, the politician I just described, he came into politics to make it less toxic and more inclusive. And before he knew it, within months, he was making it more toxic and less inclusive. Now, he did manage to realize what was happening. It took him a while and change what he was doing. And he made it less toxic and more inclusive, but it took him a lot longer. And it was very humbling for this conflict guru to find himself falling into the same traps. And politics, you know, I should say, are really designed in our country to incite high conflict. So right. You can design politics and social media platforms and other things to incite good conflict. We are very capable of that as well. That is hardwired as well.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that because, of course, politics is never far from any discussion that we have. But Amanda, if you and Jack can just hang on for a second, we invited onto this show one of the folks that you followed closely in the book, and he's got quite a story that we can learn a lot from. So let me introduce Curtis Toler into the conversation. He's with us from Chicago. He's currently director of outreach for Chicago Cred, a group whose mission is to stop deadly street violence. Curtis Toler, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I wonder if you could start by telling us the story, a little bit about your young life and when you first or what drew you into Chicago gangs when you were, like, what, less than 10 years old?
Yes. Say 9 or 10.
Yeah.
I mean, the answer is conflict, right? It just high conflict. Growing up in Chicago, at that time, not being gang or street involved, going to a school that was heavily street involved, it was, join them or try to fight them every day. So I tried to fight them every day. I didn't have any older brothers or sisters to kind of help me. And I was given some bad information that, you know, some of us are given from our parents. You know, if you can't beat them, then pick up something. Unfortunately, that pick up something went from picking up a rock to a stick to a knife and further on to a gun. And then, you know, they say that bad boys attract good girls. And that seemed like to be the case with my mom. She always seemed to, you know, get the bad guy. My father was one of the founding members of a Chicago street gang here in Chicago. And when I was conceived, my mom was 14 and he was 15. So they were very young at the time. They didn't stay together that long. And then she just kept getting with bad guys. And, it was violent. You know, like Amanda said, you know, I was a part of seeing a whole lot of violence, whether it was physical or verbal, mostly physical. And ultimately, she got with another bad guy and he killed her. And I found her in my garage dead.
Oh, my. Wow. And so I don't mean to sound gauche, Curtis, but I can't even imagine the impact that had on you. How did that change your life?
Oh, changed my life tremendously. You know, I'm still probably not totally over. I don't think you ever get over, you know, you losing someone who you truly love that way in such a horrendous manner. But it made me more violent. It made me deal with conflict the way that some people here in Chicago deal with conflict. And that's extremely violent, right? Because ultimately, a lot of folks don't want to be in conflicts by themselves. Mm-hmm. So I would bring people into this conflict. And I told Amanda one time, I read the book Machiavelli, and it said that fear lasts longer than love. And that's kind of how I led the street organization that I was in, through fear and through aggressive conflict, high conflict, because unfortunately it was a lot of loss of life during these conflicts.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Benji?
Oh, Ben. So Ben is a story that's, you know, that happens to a lot of us. You know, I can't even say that I really knew Benji, but I met Benji. And when I met him, he became like a folk hero to me because I had heard all of these stories. And what happened is that, you know, just through that one intimate conversation that we had, I befriended him. He probably wouldn't have even remembered me. Maybe he would have. But he was this icon in Chicago. You know, I thought that he was probably going to be the closest thing to Michael Jordan that I ever met. And after that meeting, he was at a park. He was shooting some hoops, and I watched him. And then he had a pickup game with some guys, and he was really, really good. We're talking about a guy that was 6'8 with moves like Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan combined. And shortly thereafter, I was at home, and I watched ESPN, and it said that Benji Wilson was the best high school basketball player in the nation. And so I was like, that's my guy. I would have conversations with people. And they were like, did you hear about Ben Wilson? I was like, yeah, that's my guy. You know what I mean? And so unfortunately, a few months later, Ben was killed. Mm-hmm. And he just so happened to be killed by a guy who lived across the alley from me, who was in a rival street gang. And so now I took on this other conflict that I didn't have with those particular guys, but in my mind, Billy, and some of his friends killed my hero, Ben Wilson.
Yeah. Amanda, we're going to hear from Curtis in a second, sort of how he moved out of this mindset that seemed to be defined by high conflict. But before that, what are some of the lessons of Curtis's early experiences that you think we ought to pay particular attention to here?
The biggest lesson from Curtis Toler is how much change is possible in mm-hmm. humans. So I want to start with that.
Yeah.
Curtis prevents homicides in Chicago on the regular today. And you heard what he had to go through and what he went through. So that's, I think, very important to start with. The other thing that I learned from Curtis's story is that there are certain fire starters, I call them, conditions that tend to lead to high conflict. And all of them were present in Curtis's life. But these are things to really watch out for and try to avoid, because it does, again, make the conflict so magnetic, right? One of them is powerful group identities. And we heard Curtis talk about the power of the gang. Often groups can be really great for society, right? But they also can make conflict go viral. Once we are part of a group or identify with a group, then we start to experience collective emotion. Mm-hmm. So the thing doesn't have to happen to us. It can happen to Benji or someone we knew or someone we never knew. And it feels like it happens to us, right? So the attack, the humiliation, the victory, the pride, all of that becomes collective. And so it expands the conflict geometrically, right? And Humiliation is another factor that reliably leads to high conflict. Evelyn Lindner, who was a psychologist who studies war and conflict, she calls humiliation the nuclear bomb of the emotions. Mm-hmm. So humiliation is the sense that you were up high and you were brought low, right? And for a lot of people, disrespect on the streets or the killing of someone you consider part of your group feels humiliating, right? And it is framed that way by conflict entrepreneurs, people around you who use the conflict, inflame the conflict for their own ends. And once something is framed as humiliation, it's very toxic, yeah. right? So that's one of those emotions that you want to try to avoid, and you don't want to humiliate your enemy because it's like you just handed him a, you know, a trunk of weapons. I mean, it just makes the conflict much more dysfunctional.
So we those do are this some to each other all the time. I mean, I feel like literally, I feel like I cannot hear anything that you're saying, Amanda, without thinking this is exactly what we do to each other all the time. So I'm trying to push back my pessimism, I guess is the best word I can come up with, but I want to create a mental space here for solutions. So Curtis, to what Amanda said at the beginning, I think is really important. Like, you right now, you are stopping violence in Chicago. So I want to ask you, what were some of the things that began to transform your mindset or pull you out of that sort of constant state of like wanting to be in high conflict? What started that transformation for you?
There were a couple of things. After being probably shot on five different occasions, once in the head, you start to look at things a lot differently. But when my son was born, I actually thought that he was coming to replace me. So I didn't think that I had a long time left to do something different. So with the amount of time that I had, I wanted to do, you know, at least be in his life doing something different. Like I said, I thought one or two things. I would either be killed or I would go to jail for a very long time. So that's when the process had really started. And then I began to read more. I think reading about like the civil rights movement and the oppression that we as a people went through, as Black and Latinx people went through. I think that was, you know, one of the things that really started transforming my mind. And I just thought, you know, and Amanda mentioned it earlier, that how the oppressed usually become the oppressor, right? And we were oppressed people. Then we became this street gang and we start, you know, becoming the oppressor because we had these big numbers and these big guns, you know, and that was just a way for me really to deal with the internal trauma that was never really dealt with. And then once I was able to speak to someone, because when my mom was killed, the counselor didn't show up at my door. But once I got older and was able to really talk to people and seek counseling and really get to the root cause of why I was being so violent and why I liked it to be involved and why I liked to be involved in this conflict, I think that's when things really started to change for me.
Tell me more. So what tools do you use in your work now to help transform the mindset of others, of the other of people you work with?
Like I said, really what happened with me is what I try to use with a lot of other people that I work with. And that's getting to the root cause and the why. Why am I involved in this conflict? And sometimes people really don't know why. You know, sometimes people don't even know the root cause. It's funny. It's not funny, but it's more ironic that this conflict that I was involved in was over a 50-year conflict, right? It was between two different groups of organizations or gangs here in Chicago. And we had been and still to this day are in this conflict for about 50 plus years. And to find out that the leaders of both organizations are locked up in the same institution in Colorado in the hills, and they are friends, right? So just to think about how many lives have been lost to know that the two guys who actually started these two groups are not even in conflict with each other. And then also finding out what kind of conflict it is. Is it historical? Is it personal? Isn't it, or is it immediate conflict? Historical means like the kind of conflict that I was talking about, a conflict that's been going on for generations. And then personal means that it's just something that happens between me and somebody else, and I've brought other people into it. And then an immediate conflict is, oh, he stepped on my shoe, or road rage or something like that.
Mm. Curtis, we've just got a little over a minute left with you, and I'm sorry to rush this last question in, but I understand that you even ended up speaking with the person who had killed your teenage hero, Benji, who we talked about a little earlier. Can you share that story with us in just about a minute here?
Yeah, not only did I speak with him, but he now works alongside of me as one of my heroes on the forefront of trying to, you know, mitigate some of this violence that's going on here in Chicago. But I met him and we had a long discussion. And again, once I was able to get to the root cause that it was just a bad day for Billy and Benji, I was able to look past the conflict that I had. And I think the only reason why I was able to look past it is because I was able to resolve the internal conflict that had been going on through so much vicarious trauma in my life. And so now me and Billy are good friends. And unfortunately, he lost his son to conflict as well. So thanks for having me, Amanda. Great book. You know, keep the good fight. You know, I'm here in the fight to resolve high conflict with you.
Curtis Toler.
Thank you, Curtis.
Yeah, he's director of outreach for Chicago CRED now, a group whose mission is to stop deadly street violence, speaking to us from Chicago. Curtis, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
We will be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking with investigative journalist Amanda Ripley. She's got a powerful new book out. It's called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. I wish it could be required reading for all Americans. Jack Beattie also joins us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jack, you listened along with us to Curtis Toler's story in the previous segment there. Before we move forward into trying to find solutions here, I was just wondering if what you thought about the lessons that Curtis's life have for the rest of us.
Well, as Amanda says, people can change. And I think she uses the idea of a saturation point. And with Curtis, it seemed to come when his son was graduating from one level of school to another. And the moment just kind of crystallized for him that he wasn't going to be there for his son, that this was some terrible pattern was going to be repeated, and as his mother had been murdered, so he'd be murdered, and his son would be without a father, and that seemed to begin it for him. In other words, that was I'm not the gang member, I'm the father. Just as with Begin, I'm not the fighter, I'm the grandfather. It was that other identity that could come in and break the power, as she says, of the binary.
Right. So, Amanda, here's my I'm going to come back to various forms of this question because I have to say I'm stuck on it. I think Curtis's example is very, very inspiring. But if we expand the focus a little bit, say, to American politics right now, where are the forces to remind people of their identities outside of the conflict identity? I can't really identify where those forces are.
Yeah, if you think about, okay, what are the other identities outside the conflict for Americans who are locked in political high conflict? One of them, just to state the obvious, is the identity of Americans. So there's a research group that I really have learned a ton from called More in Common, which looks at polarization around the world. And they have done some really interesting research on, you know, what do we have in common as Americans? Because it feels like not very much right now, right? But in fact, there are lots of things that we have in common. And guess what? Most of those opinions are not reflected on Twitter or on other social media platforms or in many news outlets or in the United States Senate. So what we've done, and this happens in every high conflict, is that the conflict entrepreneurs have been raised up. And there are lots of incentives for people to act like conflict entrepreneurs, right? For companies to act like conflict entrepreneurs. And we have to change those incentives so that there's a disincentive for conflict entrepreneurs. Just to connect it back to Curtis, because I know it does feel, well, what do we, I mean, this is a kind of an extreme violent case. But what I've found is it's not different. You know, most conflict, violent conflict in Chicago today is over social media. That's how it starts. Mm-hmm. Someone gets disrespected on Facebook, right? Or YouTube. So it's an extreme version that helps us see where we're headed and see the contours and the openings.
Yeah.
So with Curtis, one thing he did, which he didn't mention here, but he distanced himself from the conflict entrepreneurs in his own life. He literally moved apartments across town so they couldn't find him for a while. And importantly, when his cousin, who he was very close to, was brutally murdered right when he was trying to make this transition out of high conflict, when Curtis was, Curtis didn't know who did it. So he slowed down the conflict and the impulse to retaliate by literally creating some space. So for other people, that might mean getting off Twitter or changing your feed on social media. It might mean turning off cable news. It might mean changing who you interact with. Right? Because we all have people like this. I mean, I'm sure I've been a conflict entrepreneur. It is very hard as a journalist not to be at some point in this system, in this culture we've got going. So we have to be aware of it, start to name it, right?
Yeah.
And disincentivize it.
So I completely take your point and am in agreement with you that social media is like dumping fuel, jet fuel onto the flame, right? And it absolutely wildly exacerbates the incentives to remain in high conflict. But I would also argue that our politics as a whole, Amanda, is absolutely enthralled with conflict. And you know, and it comes down to because this country is deeply absorbed in identity politics, however you want to define it. We are constantly told, maybe it's, you know, through the media or social media, but we're constantly told, well, there's Republicans over here, Democrats over there, people of color over there, white working class folks over there, members of this community there, members of that community there. We're told constantly that we have to say, well, you know, I can't introduce myself if I don't say I'm Meghna, and as a female person of Indian American descent, here's what my point of view is. In fact, we're told to lead with our identity, our individual solipsistic identities, when we engage in any kind of politics. And it makes me think that I'm not sure how we break out of that, because you talked about we should recognize an identity of American. Where is that happening? Do you know? I feel like this is a problem across the spectrum, and it leaves me a little. Well, I used the word earlier, pessimistic, that we as a nation can break out of this thrall with high conflict.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. We're in a wicked problem here. And I don't mean to minimize it by telling the stories of people who have made that shift. It is really hard. It is really hard. There are a lot of forces keeping us in thrall. And probably the most painful thing for me is when I can see how the stories we are telling ourselves and the stories we are being told, some of them are just not true. Some of them are true. And some of them are just not true. And it's just like, man, if you could sort of see the tragedy of that all at once, like it would be too much to take. Like the amount of harm we are doing to each other, right, because of high conflict is really painful. The amount of fear that Americans feel, the amount of anger. You know, underneath every high conflict is usually fear.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is I just don't see where the incentives are to expand the identities, as you've been talking about. I think that that's so centrally important here.
Okay, I have a theory.
Yeah, so how do we build those?
I'm going to give you my theory.
Okay.
You may not agree, but I believe, and I have evidence for this, that there is a huge hunger in the United States for something different. There is this untapped demand for a sense of common identity, a sense of connection, for a different kind of news story, a different kind of social media platform. You know, and I tell fellow journalists this, they say, yeah, but you know, clickbait and the model and the business model. And I'm like, okay, just because we watch a car crash when we drive past it doesn't mean we like it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we know from the research that a majority of Americans are simply exhausted by this conflict. They want something else. They are proud to be Americans. They would not prefer to live somewhere else. These are not activists, right? 8 out of 10 Americans do not use Twitter, right? I think Twitter should come with a warning when you open it, especially for journalists, that says 8 out of 10 Americans do not use this. Bye-bye. Because there is, and these are the people, this is the problem with high conflict, is like all the people who are more flexible and who are not stuck in the conflict flee the scene, right? Because the extremists take over.
You know what? I believe you. I absolutely believe you. And quite frankly, it's been creeping into what I say on air over time in the past many months. I'm increasingly disgusted by how our industry, Amanda, is contributing to the persistence of the high conflict because, yes, clickbait, engagement, money, subscriptions, whatever. Like again, the incentives are not there. The structural incentives are not there to do the kind of expansion of identity or expansion of stories or getting underneath conflict that you say so clearly in the book we need in order to unwind from it. So give me an example of how that can work. I know you've got a bunch of them in the book. Maybe you talk about a New York City synagogue or the Michigan Correctional Officers Exchange, a couple of different groups that got out of high conflict.
So I just want to point out that you and I both work for legacy mainstream media outlets, and we're having this conversation. And I think someone's listening. I don't know how many people. I do think you're right that there are lots of incentives to not do this, right? But there are lots of people like us and lots of Americans who want something different. So some of it is the business incentive problem and the business model problem. And some of it is a failure of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest obstacle I run into are the conventions of newsrooms, the traditions, the assumptions of journalists, right? Because that's how we always did things. So that's just as big a problem as the business model. Then to answer your question, an example that I love is of an institution that was like, you know what? We are going to straight up change how we deal with conflict. We're going to get smart. We're going to fight smarter. That's what we need to do, right? As a country, as a world, because we're so interdependent. Like, we just can't thrive as a society, as we keep being shown over and over again. We cannot thrive until we get smarter about how we fight. We have to fight like we have kids together. You know, we can get divorced, but we still got kids together. You know what I'm saying? So like, we have to fight that way. Anyway, this synagogue, B'nai Jeshurun, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, a few years ago, almost came apart because of high conflict that was internal. It started between some of the congregants who were more conservative and protective of Israel and the rabbis who were more left-leaning. And it just blew up and it took everyone by surprise. It was on the front page of the New York Times. It was pretty ugly. People were leaving the synagogue because the rabbis had supported a UN vote on Palestine. You know, we don't need to get into the details. It's complicated. But the point is it really tapped into people's identities that we've talked about.
Yep.
And this understory of that conflict had not been investigated. So things almost blew up. The rabbis apologized, tried to move on, hoped it wouldn't happen again, which is what all of us do typically in sudden unexpected conflict within our group. And then it happened again, like a year later. It just, you know, because a buried understory doesn't go away. And then finally, with the suggestion of one of the congregants, the rabbis decided to bring in conflict mediators who had worked in the Middle East and lean into the conflict and just change totally how they dealt with conflict. Instead of avoiding it, instead of just, you know, being at each other's throat in public, they decided to lean into it. So they, for a year, they would have these, like, you know, workshops and conversations, and they worked on listening for understanding, not trying to persuade, getting curious about how they each other could have such different opinions. It was hard work, you know, but they did the work. And then when the next conflict flared up, which is which over interfaith marriage in this case, which has also torn asunder many houses of worship in the past, they were able to deal with it. And it actually was interesting. It brought them closer together. There's lots of research on married couples who are able to do this, where conflict makes them stronger, tighter, not weaker.
Huh. Terrific example, Amanda. Now, Jack, let me turn back to you, because I wonder if you, if there's another example of two from history and how there are sort of elements of pulling out of high conflict that have actually worked amongst nations.
Yes, and I think the 20th century shows the outstanding example, the way World War I ended and the way World War II ended. As you remember, World War I ended with a punitive peace, humiliating peace, the Peace of Versailles, that ground the German every German face. And the result, of course, was the rise of Nazism. At the end of the Second World War, there were calls to make Germany a pastoral society. Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, had a plan. We'll just turn it into a pastoral society, get rid of all the problems that could come out of Germany by way of industry. That route wasn't taken. FDR instead went in the direction of the United Nations, and instead of reparations, as at the end of World War I, and a guilt clause, as in the Versailles Treaty, no. There was the Marshall Plan, which essentially aided Germany, aided the enemy. It was reparations to Germany. And that, which Churchill rightly called the most unsordid act in history, that showed that even great nations, even in victory, can learn from their mistakes and step away from high conflict toward a peaceful resolution.
Amanda, do you see evidence in the United States of the capacity for that kind of learning?
I think that we're certainly capable of it. I think it'd be good to get there. Jack, those are excellent examples. And the whole trick that we have, right, is can we get to a saturation point as a country without going through a war? Mm. Can we skip that step, right? So one of the things I try to do is to talk to people who work in conflict in other countries who have seen a lot more political violence of late, and see how they think about it and how you can sort of skip steps, if you can, to get to where they are without sort of mass loss of life. So one of the things that we know is really important is complicating our narratives about each other. So a lot of this work can be done in journalism, not all of it, right? But some of it can be done in politics as well. One of the things that is unusual about the United States is the way we elect people in this like zero sum, winner take all fashion. And we know that in other countries that have third parties and ranked choice voting and things like that, there's more trust and less polarization. That's something that Maine has done, Alaska has done. We could do that here, and it should lead us in a better direction.
Should. Let's hope so. The book is High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. I really, really hope that as many people read this book as possible. It's a very important piece of work. Amanda Ripley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. It's always great to have you, Jack. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.